A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on August 3, 1986, in the series God's Prodigal Love, entitled, Is That All There Is? The scripture readings are Ecclesiastes 2, verses 1 through 11, and Luke 15, verses 11 through 32. The text for the sermon is Luke 15, verse 14. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
There's a popular song of a few years ago that I tried to track down, but unsuccessfully. If any of you have it in your record files, I wish you would give it to me. It's Peggy Lee singing, Is That All There Is? It's a story about various situations in life, and it always comes back to that question, is that all there is? If that's all there is, then, you know, let's just tie one on and be on with it. The prodigal didn't use those words, but he might have. It didn't take him very long to come to the realization that he'd made a tragic mistake. The younger son in this story is a parable of the person that thinks that autonomy is where it is, that one needs to get free of the father, out of the father's house, that one needs to be autonomous, that is, literally, to be a law unto oneself, to live without restraint, without constraint, without restriction, without law, to live purely according to the dictates of one's own mind and heart, to be totally free, which is not freedom, but is license. Autonomy leads to boredom and dullness of life. And the younger son in Jesus' story could well have affirmed that which was spoken by the Old Testament writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, who wrote as though he were the king of Israel, traditionally Solomon, but this was not Solomon. This was someone who wrote probably a couple of centuries before Jesus, who wrote in the genre of literature called the wisdom literature. And it's strange that he even made the scriptures. He's a cynic, he's a skeptic. And he says, I tried it all. And my testimony is that it's all emptiness, vanity, chasing the wind. If you read Ecclesiastes, you'll find him telling how he went after wisdom, philosophical wisdom, the flights of the mind, how he engaged in great building projects, great endeavors, great enterprises. How he indulged himself in every pleasure conceivable. And then one day woke up to say, is that all there is? Emptiness, chasing the wind. The younger son thought that it would be so neat if he could just get away. If he could just be from under the shadow of his father, if he could just be his own person, if he could just be turned loose. And very quickly, he realized that it was a phantom. All of his fantasy, a phantom. And what he had really done is gotten himself into emptiness, boredom. He had lost the lust of life, and he came to himself. He said, is that all there is? The elder brother probably could appreciate that question too. He well also might have said, is that all there is? His younger brother wanted freedom. His younger brother took off, got out of the father's house, lived high and wild for a season, and recognized life's emptiness. Not so the elder brother. He stayed home. He was obedient. He dotted every I. He crossed every T. He was one of those persons that wanted to do it all so right that no one would ever have a word to say about him. He was not less self-centered than the younger son. He was as much caught up in his own self-project as the wild one. He was waiting for the day when the old man died and he got the estate. He was counting his fortune already, and he was making sure that he didn't trip up. He was upright and he was uptight. He did it all right, and he was angry inside. And the anger finally manifested itself on the day that his younger brother came home, and the father, full of joy, with his prodigal love, poured out his heart. And the sounds of the party brought out unbridled anger in the heart of the elder brother. He too said, "Is that all there is? Do I work hard all my days? Do I dot the I's and cross the T's? Do I plow the corn, plow the field and hoe the corn and keep the herd and be reasonable and responsible and moderate and temperate and right in all I do, and I come up with a situation like this where that young rascal comes home only to have a party thrown for him?" Oh, he was angry. Upright and uptight generally results in a lot of anxiety and pent-up anger because the elder brother was no more in relationship with the father than was the young rascal. He was no more living in a relationship of spontaneous trust and love than was his younger brother. He was as far from the father's heart as the young one. There was as much alienation in the field as there was in the far country. And so he was angry, and probably was saying in quite a different context, and yet the same question: is that all there is? And the father came out and pleaded with him to come in, and the story is left there. We don't know what happened, at least according to the parable. And I suppose Jesus couldn't give the end of the parable because the end hadn't happened yet, because those to whom he was speaking were the religious leaders who were grumbling because of his behavior with publicans and sinners and harlots and earthly types. And he was speaking to elder brothers who were grumbling about his association and fellowship with the flawed and failed mass of humanity. And of course the story wasn't over. He was telling the story in order to try to get through to the elder brothers that he was addressing. And the conclusion wasn't there yet. We know the conclusion, however. We know the conclusion because we know the gospel. The conclusion is that the elder brother never did come home. The elder brother killed the father. He was in that Passover crowd that cried out, "Crucify him, crucify him. We have no king but Caesar." But for our purposes this morning, let's just recognize that there were two brothers and they were both alienated. One by doing it all wrong and one by doing it all right, and neither one of them living in a trusting, gracious, loving relationship with the Father. Both of them breaking the Father's heart. One of them because he moved out, and the other because he lived under the roof with estrangement and alienation. Neither one of them living in love. Is that all there is? Seems like it's maybe easier to sow your wild oats and find out that life is empty apart from God. Seems like it's easier to come back home when you've fallen on your face than when You've lived all the time upright and uptight. The anger gets in the way. But no matter, the story is about failing to live in loving relationship. Now look what we do with that story. Look how we ruin that story. Look how we miss the point. What do we do with that story? You've heard 100 sermons on that story. What do we do with it? We moralize it. We make it a story about being good and being bad. We make it a story about the young son who went into the far country and lived riotously. High living, fast living, living in the fast track. And then we say with a long finger of judgment, don't you live in the fast track of life. Don't dirty your skirts with worldly things. Don't smoke and drink and dance. At least that's what I couldn't do. I don't know what they can't do today. I'm too old to understand what youth isn't supposed to do today. We moralize the story. And the prodigal becomes an example to us of how self-destructive it is to get out into the far country, away from the father's house. And we lay all kinds of heavy guilt on those who are growing up by making them think that the things which are normal and natural and a part of being human are really nasty and sinful. And so we warn against leaving the father's house. And we admit that the elder brother had a bad attitude. And his problem was that he was self-righteous and he didn't realize his need, and he should have realized his need. But still, he made the right choice in terms of being upright. See how we ruin the story? See how we miss the point? Jesus wasn't talking about morality. Jesus wasn't talking about being good or being bad. Jesus was not talking about vice or virtue. Morality, vice, or virtue doesn't have anything to do with the story. Jesus was saying to those who were condemning his behavior, because he associated with ordinary folk who had mud on their feet and scars on their souls, because he came into their midst and touched them and hugged them and said to them, God loves you and my presence here is a sign of God seeking you and pursuing you, and you who are lost, why don't you just open up your life and your heart and let God embrace you, because he's just waiting to welcome you home. He was saying to those who were condemning him for being what he was in the midst of that community of people as a sign of salvation, he was saying to them, alienation is the problem. Living life without God is the problem. Living out of relationship is the problem. And you can be miles away, whether you're in the far country or whether you're under the Father's roof. Whether you never darken the door of the church or you warm the pew every week. You can be miles away and all kinds of estrangement and alienation can be present. If you're living life without that conscious, deliberate, spontaneous, joyful, playful, gracious, loving, trusting relationship with God, then life has not yet come to full blossom. Jesus was saying that life is empty. No matter what you do, no matter how full you make it of things and pursuits and pleasures and all kinds of good endeavors, life remains empty unless life is lived in relationship with the good and gracious God who stands there looking down the road, wondering when his sons and daughters will come home. God knows that in our contemporary culture in the last quarter of the 20th century, we need to hear that message. For probably since King Solomon, there's never been a people who have been able better to satisfy every whim of the heart, to accomplish and acquire every fantasy of the mind, to surround themselves with goods and things and all kinds of marvelous pursuits. And yet, if it has not dawned on you at some point, it has dawned on many of your neighbors, the fact that all of that can still leave us empty. And the question is that all there is? We get bored so quickly. We pay big money to go to some far-off exotic place and live in quarters that are only half of what we have at home. Someone told me the other day about bringing their sailboat up Lake Michigan against the wind. And she said to him, "Is this fun?" And I love the t-shirt down at Chinook Pier that says, "Are we having fun yet?" Is this all there is? Oh, we dream and we fantasize and we reach for the stars and we chase the wind and we come up empty. And the younger son said, "I'm going to go home." And the elder son stood there angry and said, "Damn it." Secular culture in the last quarter of the 20th century could well ask the question, is that all there is? We've been shocked as a people recently when two outstanding athletes died from an overdose of cocaine. And suddenly we're beginning to realize that that is a real threat to our society, and maybe we'll get on with it. But the elder brother in us says, "Isn't that awful? What a terrible thing for them to do. What kind of generation is this that's just rising?" We don't realize that drugs and all of that, which is a part of the contemporary scene, is just a sign of the emptiness. Rather than the long finger of judgment, what we ought to feel is some compassion and say, gee, how empty life must be. There must be no sense of living in relationship with a good and gracious God who gives meaning and direction to life. God knows our secular culture is a life structured apart from God. The secular is good because creation is good, but secularism is a posture of life that takes no cognizance of the transcendent of God, of any ground beneath us or overshadowing over us. To live then in this one-dimensional world. And soon there aren't thrills enough to keep us going and life comes up empty. Not because people are evil, but because people are out of relationship with the God who gives meaning and direction to life. The elder brother in us would condemn. When I was in London a couple of years ago, punk culture was going rampant in Piccadilly Circus. Strangest costumes you've ever seen. Most outlandish hairdos in the world. And what were they? Detestable youth to be kept at arm's length? Or were they young people screaming to say, "Does anybody care? Does anybody see me? Is there any meaning in this world?" Which we respectable adults have handed to them. There's a lot of emptiness about us. I'm going to get into trouble now because I'm going to get into an area of which I have no knowledge or expertise, but I've already been told about that, so I'll try again. I don't like dissonant music. I don't like music that I mean, I don't know how to describe it because I'm not a musician, but it to me sounds like noise. It seems like who's ever doing that is making noise. Beethoven and Bach and Mozart made melody. I'm out of my territory, but when I was in the Netherlands years ago, there was a guy named Apple, an artist, who took a stick and picked up gobs of paint and slapped it on the canvas. And when you saw the finished product, what you thought had happened was that somebody picked up gobs of paint and threw it on the canvas. And I am colorblind, so I can't appreciate the subtlety of color combinations. But it looked to me like somebody just went like that, which seems to me is an expression of an artist who is crying out against emptiness. Now, I don't know anything about music, and I don't know anything about art, but it seems to me that art is a reflection of the heart and the mind and the soul of a culture. And if a culture is empty, will not art manifest it that way? I don't know, but it seems to me that there's something to that, some connection there. So what do we do? Well, thank God we're Christians. Thank God we're in the church. Thank God we've been rescued from all that. Thank God you know, I'm only kidding now. Thank God you know that we are part and parcel of the contemporary scene, and whether we've been out in the far country living in the fast lane or whether we have been uptight and upright, virtuous day in and day out, there's only one question. And that is, are we living in that joyful, gracious, personal, loving, trusting relationship with God? Contemporary culture certainly needs to know that that's not all there is. And someone needs to say, hey, the Father's waiting. Looking down the road, lay down your arms and come home. There are giants in the land marching to and fro in these election days. I'm afraid, I'm scared to death of the super righteous elder brother moral majority types who are going to break the back of Satan, frankly. The world knows it's living in hell. It doesn't have to be condemned for its gross sins, its pornography and its homosexuality and its all of the sins of the self-righteous who go marching through the land with all this righteous indignation, pointing long fingers and judging people and driving people away from the church. What the world out there needs to know that's taking drugs and having too much booze and chasing pleasure, what they have to know is that that's not all there is. There's God who's gracious, who says to all cocaine users and boozers and pleasure seekers and profligate people, when you get it out of your system, come on home and I'll put my arms around you and show you that that's not all there is.